A scene in Frederick Tutton's 1971 debut novel, The Adventures of Mao on the Long March, Mao Zedong and his wife sit one night in their encampment, sipping tea and talking about love and sex and Beethoven. At one point, Mao says, "The truly wise, after all their speculations, will be led into the common path and, in homage to the human nature that pervades them, will gather gold and till the earth and set out trees and build a house." "The campfire is your hearth," she replies. "The revolution your home, my dear husband." "No, the revolution is my poem," he says. "Well then, something is wrong with the imagery." "What else?" "The structure is too random." "Revise after you have completed it," she suggests. "It will cease to exist when finished," he replies. This seems apt to me now as I consider the challenge of describing an artist whose work has remained revolutionary in the basic sense that it continually uproots expectation and habit, while he himself, by dint of brilliance, kindness, generosity as a teacher, and production, has become a pillar of the American avant-garde. A lot of what happens in The Adventures of Mao on the Long March has nothing to do with the historical Mao. An old Jewish couple sit shiva for their daughter who is married a goy. A poem called Hymn to a Cockroach is close read in plenary academic over-jargon. Several page quotations from Hawthorne are collaged in amid the action. But it is also about Mao on the Long March, struggling against Chiang Kai-shek, developing his ideas, and so on. Like so much of Tutton's writing, it's laugh-out-loud funny, and also actually sad, two of the hardest modes for fiction to achieve. More than formally innovative, it's a book that, like If on a Winter's Night a Traveler or Blood and Guts in High School, invents and explores its own distinct form while at the same time participating in the rich tradition of the novel. P.S. Happy 73rd birthday, Kathy Acker. What? Since then, Tutton has published four more novels, a short story collection, a prodigious body of critical writing on contemporary art, the screenplay to Andrzej Żuławski's 1981 cult film Possession, and most recently, a wonderful memoir, My Young Life, just out in paperback from Simon & Schuster. P.S., you should get it if you don't have it. If you don't know where to buy books online right now, a lot of bookstores will send you books, and if they won't, bookshop.org is a website that will send you books in the mail and make a contribution to the independent brick and mortar bookseller of your choice. Amazing. I'm gonna go there right now. Oh my god. Frederick Tutton has been recognized with many awards, a Guggenheim Fellowship, three Pushcart Prizes, an O'Henry Award, and an award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Having been born and raised in the Bronx of the 1930s and 40s, I think he's a special kind of hero for a lot of people who grew up in the unfussy old New York that finance has long been toiling to devour, though the present strangeness seems capable, perhaps, for better and worse, of bringing it back. And not just New Yorkers, but anyone who's been a kid and dreamed of an artist's life long before really knowing what that means, who's endured a formative sense that there was more around them than most people knew how to talk about. For all its refinement, erudition, and refusal of boredom, I think the most recognizable quality of Frederick Tutton's writing may be its unpretentiousness. Like a feral-hearted wanderer in some fantastic museum, Tutton's voice drifts, lingers on pleasures and fascinations, and then moves on. Anyhow, I could go on, but I think the point clearly is that I am very excited to introduce Frederick Tutton. There's no sound on the internet, so please do something wild in your computer camera to welcome him, clap like this, and let's go crazy for Frederick Tutton on the internet.
Oh, thank you, Ian. Thank you, Tasso, and thank you, James, for having me here. I'm very happy to be here. You know, in all the gloom around us, this is such a wonderful light moment, such a beautiful moment. And V, thank you so much. I was so moved by what you were writing, what you've written. I really was speechless for a while. It's marvelous. I'm so happy to know you, even if it's only virtually in this space. But thank you so much for this, your wonderful work. Well, after the introduction, I don't know what I could say to illuminated. I'm going to read today just a very small section, a very few pages, I hope. Hope it's pages for you. You feel that's only a few pages. It's a memoir called My Life. And I always thought when I was younger, I would never do such a book. I would never write a memoir. I'd never write, because I thought it was too easy. I thought that it was too egomaniacal and too self, and I guess I did read memoirs, but the ones I like to read were about interesting people with interesting things, like Rosa Luxemburg. I love Rosa Luxemburg's memoirs, a two-volume memoir, fantastic. I love memoirs about revolutionary people. I love memoirs about exciting people, artists mostly. But I don't, at a certain moment, I thought to myself, it's time. It's just time. It's time to say what I felt about my life and the lives around me mostly, about people I loved very, very much and whom I missed at this very moment as we're speaking. Not always famous people, certainly not. The only famous person in the whole book is Hemingway. When I went to see him, I was 19 years old, and I was in Havana. It's a long story, it's in the book. And I crashed on the assumption he was waiting for me. Don't ask me why. And so that, Hemingway, to see Hemingway in Havana was a kind of exciting moment of my life. But everyone else in the book, people like Leonard Ehrlich, who was my teacher at City College of New York, where I went as an undergraduate and later became a professor there. I loved it so much. There's a section about this man called Leonard Ehrlich, and no one's heard of him. I'm sure none of you have heard of him. When he was 25 years old, he wrote a novel called God's Angry Man. It was about James Brown. It was about the revolutionary, the anti-abolitionist, John Brown. 25 years old, he became a sensation overnight. The New York Times hailed him as one of America's greatest new young writers. He was praised. He was rewarded. He was a star. He could not finish a second book. Years and years went by. People were expecting it. Then after a while, they don't expect it. And after a while, you sort of vanish. And he lived with a kind of sadness, a kind of weight of failure. When he was teaching at City College, I was a student. He was very tough-minded, kind, but very tough-minded. His greatest criticism of work, of any work, was that the prose, he'd say, the prose has no dignity. It's about my friendship with him and my love for him. And I wanted very much to have him on record. I wanted him to say thank you to him, although it's too late now, I suppose. But I wanted to thank him for his kindness. I want to thank him for his encouragement. And I wanted to tell also the end of that story, which is that one day, by the way, he'd give these marvelous parties for his students. He had certain favorite students, and you were under his charm, under his aegis, and you were feeling protected by life. And he'd have these marvelous parties and writers, and I'd meet these extraordinary writers in his house, cocktail parties. One day he said, "Let's go to lunch." We went to lunch. He said, "I have to ask you something. Would you come over to my apartment? I want to show you something." "Of course, Leonard." And we go, and he goes into a room. He always had these huge apartments. He had some income. He never had to really teach, but he had some income. So he had these cavernous apartments on the Upper West Side where he gave the parties. And he took out two boxes, these kinds of, you know, I guess, acid-free boxes, I guess we think them now. And he takes one out, and there's a typewritten manuscript. Pages, a whole book. And I said, "What is this, Lenny?" He said, "It's my second novel." "Oh," I said, "this is so wonderful. It's so wonderful. I'm so happy." He said, no, "it's all finished but the last chapter. I never finished the last chapter." He opens up the second volume, second box, and it's the same leather manuscript, but minus the last chapter. I was too young. I was just a kid. I was 19. I didn't know enough. He was my professor, so it was very hard. I guess maybe it's a generational thing. My generation, it was very hard to even call a professor by his first name. Even he said, "Call me by my first name." It was very, very difficult to do that. I always Professor Ehrlich. But I said, "Leonard, I don't know what to say. Why don't you get dictated to someone? Do it. You get it over with." I would have said to him, I'll just give it to me and I'll write whatever you want to write." No. So that's Ehrlich. He died in a kind of an anonymity. and all his papers, everything, include, I'm sure there they are at the Berg Collection, New York Public Library, has those unfinished manuscripts. If I were a publisher, I'd publish those books, with and without the ending. It doesn't matter. I mean, not every book has to be finished to be beautiful. There's that wonderful Ehrlich person in my life there, but many people, my grandmother, my Sicilian grandmother, who raised me basically, and my wild father, my wonderfully crazy, irresponsible, radical father, who one night woke us up 3-4 in the morning. He always disappeared for months and months and months. One night, 3 or 4 in the morning, the doorbell rings. We had no telephone. And he came in the apartment with 2 big pails of water. We thought it was water. He was a Southerner from Savannah, Georgia. He had this marvelous Southern, beautiful, charming Southern, soft Southern accent. And he said, my mother, Madeline, how much money do you have in the house? She said, I don't know, Rex, I have the rent money. Go get it. And he said, son, how much money do you have? I had like 18 cents in my piggy bank. Go get the money. What he did was put us in the kitchen. It was a long kind of narrow kitchen. And he took from the pail, the 2 pails, 2 lobsters. And he said, Madeline and son, Fred, which lobster do you want to bet on? We're going to have a lobster race. Well, you know, I had to go. She said, Rex, Fred has to go to school tomorrow morning. You can't keep, oh, it's okay if he misses school. Let's have the lobster race. It's better than the ponies. So I sat there half asleep and half awake while he was prodding the lobsters and making sure that they wouldn't get off course. And that was my father. I mean, how could you beat that as a father? He's so interesting and so passionate and so romantic. It's hard to see other people who are not like that. It's difficult. He consumes your imagination. The other person I wrote about, among many people I wrote about in this book, is a man called John Resco. I want to mention him. I want everyone to hear about this man. John Resco, it goes back to what I'm going to read today. I was impassioned. I was a kid in the Bronx. We had, I know the violin comes out when people talk about being in poverty, but it was so dire that we really had no food. No electricity sometimes. We had to go to my aunt's house to find some food. That's how bad it was. But in all of that, I had the craziest idea as I grew up as a teenager that I wanted to be an artist, a painter. Part of that idea came from, you know, the Don Quixote was inflamed by the books he read, by the books of chivalry and by the books of knighthood. And he got wild. He's burned. I think Cervantes actually says his imagination was burning. It burned. And he went out and he sallied forth to change the world, to bring justice to the world. Books do change people, especially if you're young at a certain age. And I had been reading, because we had no television, of course, we had radio. I've been reading all the time. And I've been read books like Lust for Life about Van Gogh, The Moon and Sixpence about Gauguin. There was the movies, especially, there was a movie, Lust for Life, there was a movie, Gauguin, about Gauguin. But most especially, was a film called American in Paris. It's a musical. It's a wonderful Gershwin music. It's a wonderful, if you haven't seen it, it's so warming and so delightful and so beautiful. Minnelli directed it, the beautiful choreography, beautiful everything. And it's about a young American, I guess GI after the war, stays in Paris. And says he wants to be a painter. So he's a painter in Paris. And he lives in a kind of top floor, a garret, a chambre de bonne, I think they would call it today, with a cafe down below. And he has a good friend, Oscar Levant, who plays Gershwin. And of course, he has no money. He has pittance, so I guess maybe from the GI Bill. And of course, the French are so loving of Americans and so loving of artists, they give him free meals. Everything is just marvelous to be an American in Paris in the 50s. He falls in love. He has a romantic life, and he paints. And I was about 15. When I was 15, 15, as I saw that, I said, this is the life I want. I don't want the Bronx. I want Paris. I want to be there and live in a chambre de bonne. But I didn't know French. I had never studied French. I didn't even know how to think of going there, since I had not one word of French. But I wanted to be in Paris and live that bohemian life, and live a life of glamorous artists and friends and poets and smoking and drinking, you know, in cafes. So I dropped out of high school. In those days, if you dropped out of high school, they thought you were going to be a juvenile delinquent, only bad boys. And one of my neighbors, marvelous woman, a real intellectual. I mean, real intellectual. She later left her husband and children to go to Paris to live with a Frenchman who was a scholar of James Joyce. She left everyone to do what she wanted. What an example, like Gauguin. And she said to me, you know, Fred, you don't have any friends who are artists. You know anything about art. You know anything. I'm going to introduce you to someone. I think they were also worried about my maybe criminal part, that the criminality might take over in some way. So she introduced me to a man. I remember going to see him with her one night in Park Chester, New York. And that Park Chester is those housing complexes, you know, they all look alike. They're dreadful. But I guess it was cheap in the days. You can get a nice apartment, a couple, maybe a bedroom or two bedrooms for not much. And I go to see him and I see these paintings on the wall. One was a huge painting of garbage pails, but they weren't realistic. They weren't, you know, American realist garbage pails. They were sort of askew. They had red drops. There was no sidewalk. They were just abstract garbage pails. And I said, who did that? And this man was John Resco. And he said, I did it. I said, oh, really? He said, yeah, these are my paintings, Fred. Then I got very interested. And I look around the room and there were bookcases full of books. Bookcases and paintings. I thought, fuck, this is really incredible. And we got to talk, and he asked me some questions. What am I reading? What am I doing? Have I read Kafka? No, I hadn't read Kafka. And he went into another room and brought me a copy of The Castle. And I left and I said, oh, this is so wonderful. Thank you. Caroline Cole, her name, and I took the bus back to the building. I said, Caroline, I'm so happy. I'm so grateful to you. And we became friends, John and I. He really was my father. He was everything a father might want to be, should be, could be, that you would dream of having. Kind, interesting, interested in you, just appropriately so didn't push too much. I loved him deeply, loved him. This man had been in prison for 20 years in Dannemora Prison, which was the Alcatraz of the North, one of the most worst prisons in America. 20 years. He was 17 years old, Christmas Eve, Lower Manhattan, Lower East Side, about where I live now, around 12th Street, and wife and a child, Christmas Eve, no food. It's hard, maybe we'll come to understand what that is now with the Great Recession waiting for us, that there are people who won't have food. People have no food now. No food. And an older man in the neighborhood said to him, I know how to get some money. Come with me. And they went up to the Bronx, of all fucking places to go, and held up a grocery store. The guy behind the counter came at him with a bat. Older man said to John, take this and shoot him. And he gave John the pistol, and John stupidly shot the guy and killed him. They were immediately taken out. They were immediately arrested right out of the grocery store. The cops were there. The older man was given, they're both given death sentences. Both were given death sentences, and the older man was electrocuted in 6 months. Resco was continually get reprieves. His last reprieve was 45 minutes before the electric chair, 45 minutes. Then Governor Roosevelt, who became President Roosevelt, all the petitions from the priest, from his mother, he had no record, he had been a good boy. So they gave him life sentence in Dannemora Prison, where he began to paint and write and draw and have a life and become a whole different person. It's a book in which he's included in this book. Many things about him. It's wonderful. He wrote a book called Reprieve. I wanted to get it reprinted. I begged them to try to reprint it, you know, at the New York Review of Books. It's a marvelous book. It's a marvelous book. It's his memoir of being in prison for 20 years and how he got out. By the way, it's interesting. One of the people who signed a petition, among the many, many, many people who signed a petition to release him, saying he's a reconstructed person, he's an asset to society, let him go. One of the people who signed that letter was Groucho Marx. I thought that always moved me. Groucho Marx would do that. So go back again. I dropped out of high school. I met Rusko, changed my life. And I got a job in a mailroom in a Sperry and Hutchinson company, which was then the green stamps. They don't have green stamps anymore, but if you went to all over America, all the supermarkets everywhere, if you went to a place, you bought like $400 worth of stuff, $2 worth of stuff, you gave you a stamp and a book and you put a stamp in it, then you fill up the book and you get a prize. You get a refrigerator, you get a radio, you get a comb. I worked in that mailroom. And on Saturdays, I took classes at the Art Students League. Now, I knew there were abstract painters, of course. I knew there was Pollock was around, all those people were around. But my idea, maybe John influenced me in that thinking. My idea was, if you could not draw the figure, if you could not draw, nothing could come of your work. You can just splatter it on a canvas, you can piss on it, you can do whatever you want to do to it, but it's not really serious. It's decoration. So strange thing as an aside, I who love those painters, who love Pollock and Klein and de Kooning and everyone, not de Kooning so much, but all of them whom I adored, Rothko, it's strange that at this time in life, maybe one becomes more conservative, but at this time in life, one day I went into the Met and I saw these huge, the huge room with huge canvases by those artists. I kept thinking, you know what? It's really not as interesting as I thought it was. It is kind of wallpaper, very attractive, very stunning. I'm waiting to hear the report of that. To hear back from my friends after I said that. So I thought I have to be able to draw. That was key, and to draw as Picasso had, as Matisse had, as everyone had, from the figure. That was the beginning. All principle began from the body. All art. I took these classes. And what I'm going to read to you now, I hope I haven't gone overboard in time, is a little chapter about my first class at the Art Students League. What year was it? 1952, I think. By the way, just to say, anyone of you were raised in the boroughs, like the Bronx or Brooklyn or Manhattan or Queens, you know that when you live there, coming to Manhattan is always referred to as, I'm going to the city. Is if you weren't really part of this, I'm going to the city, because Manhattan seemed so far away and so different. And for me, it was. I mean, for me, it was magic. For me, the idea of going to Greenwich Village or looking at the bookstores on Fourth Avenue when I was a kid. So this may have been maybe the second time I ever went down to 57th Street, where our student league was, or 7th Avenue. 7th Avenue was off my line. My line was the 3rd Avenue L, Lexington Avenue. So even going west, it was a little odd and maybe a little frightening. But anyway, I went there, and this is the, I just want to finish my other thing about the book. The book starts in 1946 when I was a kid in the Bronx, about 10, and goes from there to City College of New York, which was my haven, my island of joy. I loved every minute I was there. It was a marvelous and wonderful and exciting place with brilliant professors. I mean, they called it the proletarian Harvard, and they meant it. It was the Harvard for poor people. Our education was priceless and wonderful. And I loved the students there. I loved sitting at the table and talking politics day and night. I loved everything about it. So it's about the Bronx, about City College, about going to Mexico. I had an idea at a certain moment that I loved the Mexican mural painting. I got fascinated by it. Rivera, Siqueiros, Orozco. I got fascinated by the painting. I got fascinated by the politics of the painting. I thought, this is really interesting. To make art that's public and social, historical, speaking to people, not just on the canvas for the bourgeoisie, not just the painting for rich people to have, but for people to go into places where they congregate, into go schools and to post offices and see all this wonderful art made by the people, by their people, for their people. So I went to Mexico to study. I'll explain that in the book about how I got some money to do it, because I had no money. I went to Mexico to study at the University of Mexico, to study at the Mexican mural painting and pre-Columbian art. I met all these extraordinary Mexican artists. Wonderful, wonderful. They became friends with them. I was their pet gringo. I was like I was a rarity. I was the leftist gringo. You know, I was 19. It's Mexico. I'm coming back to New York, back to City College, leaving City College and going to spend the two most miserable years of my life, which is all of us who had lives with misery at some point, and maybe there are some more miserable than others. This was the most miserable 12 years of my whole life. I hope even these last years I have left, I'll never replicate them. 2 years at Syracuse University as a teaching assistant. I had come from the bowels of the cafeterias of New York City, City College, politics, art, talk, literature. And there I go to Syracuse, football. It's a football team. I don't even saw a football game in my life, and certainly not in life. Football and stuff and this, and people had money, and people, kids were going on sports cars. It was an astonishing radical transformation for me to see what America was like, to see what really was like. It wasn't the City College, it wasn't New York, Manhattan. It was really a shock. Yeah, so there was Syracuse and some adventures there, a lot of sexual adventures. That was the only interesting thing about that place. You know, it's like in Kundra, when you're oppressed, sex becomes very important. The love of it, the romance of it, the excitement of it, the narrative of it. Then Syracuse, then back to New York. Oh, I missed Havana. Well, I think I mentioned it earlier. Going to see Hemingway. Oh, I have to go back to this. Of course, he was shocked that I was there with my girlfriend, but he liked the girlfriend. He liked her very much. He said, you can't come in. You just can't come in. I said, well, we went under a misapprehension that so-and-so had, and told us that he had spoken to you and that we were going to come. Of course, he lied, some driver. But he liked my girlfriend very much. And he said, well, come in for a little while. We stayed for 2 hours, 2 hours with Hemingway. And in fact, at the end of it, it was sort of awkward because he said, well, if you want to stay, there's a swimming pool, there's some trunks, go to the cabana. You can. And I just felt we had our moment. And I also felt, I say it in the book, a certain kind of sadness for him. Even then, he killed himself like a year or two later, or 3 years later, or something like that. So apart from that episode, coming back to New York from Syracuse, not having a job, finding out when I got back, a letter that came to me saying I was expelled from the graduate program. All I had not finished my coursework. I never wrote the papers. I'd been writing them. I was like Ehrlich. I'd write them, but they weren't perfect enough. They had to be perfect. They had to be so astonishingly brilliant that I had to have these professors say, God, we never had a student like you in a whole life. You know, maybe with these papers, I'd get a job somewhere at Harvard or Princeton on this basis of these brilliant papers I was going to write, Melville on Hawthorne. I just couldn't do it. So I had incompletes, and finally they threw me out. So there I am back in Manhattan, back in the Bronx, living with my mother and working, luckily for me, in a bookstore. But what was interesting then was my first real apartment in New York on the Lower East Side, on 8th Street between C and D. Now, that was 1962, 8th Street between C and D, which has now become condo land. It's now places where rich people buy apartments. It's now a place where beautiful models have $2 million, $3 million apartments right in my neighborhood. The whole world has changed. But this was Avenue C and D, the projects were there, then the river and the park. It was marvelous. I know everyone says the past is past. Everyone glamorizes the past. Everyone says, oh, the past was so great. But the truth is the past was better than it is today. My past anyway. The past was better. It was better, period. Painters, writers, poets, we all knew each other. We all went out together. We had fun together on little money. We had fun. We had love affairs. We had stuff, but it was fun. It was dangerous. A, 3, C, and D. You never knew when you came home if your door would be broken into, if the fire escape window had been smashed into. You never knew when you were going to be robbed, how long are we going to be robbed. People would actually leave on their on their door notes in my building. You've taken everything. I have nothing up at the radio. I mean, notes of the burglars, because, you know, then you go out into the park. Tompkins Square Park on a Sunday, and you see all your stuff that you've been sold on blankets. People selling them. You know, you buy it back. It's part of the game. So that last part of the book is my Lower East Side life. The people I knew. I mean, some of you may know who this person is. He was a kind of, he would have been very upset to call him a beat poet, because although Kerouac liked his work very much, he didn't want to be known as a beat poet. His name was Jack Micheline. His real name was Harvey Shapiro from the Bronx. Jack Micheline was an uneducated, I mean, formerly uneducated autodidact poet. He was a true anarchist. He was a true anarchist. He had no place of residence. He had no income that you could show. He just wrote poetry, and he slept with different people in different places, in their houses, in their couches, whatever. He was just a wandering poet. Find that today. Anyway, Micheline was a wonderful person. I loved him very much. I loved all these people. So I was very sick. I couldn't go to work. And he found out by calling the bookstore where I worked that I was sick. And I had a phone then. And he called me and said, I'm gonna come over and see you, Fred. I was feverish. And he said, what do you need? I said, nothing. Just come, Jack. And he said, I'll be there in an hour. Okay, because Jack had no money for car fare. He walked all the way from about where the docks were, maybe in the 40s, to walk to my place in C&D. His favorite, maybe it was 15 cents then. And he came to my place. I was still feverish. And he had a brown paper bag. And he unloads the bag, and there are tomatoes he had bought on a stand. And he'd have these fruit stands and vegetable stands out in the street. I don't know if they have them anymore. And he said, let's do it. He washes the tomatoes. He cuts them up with salt and pepper on the dish and with some cold water. And he said, Fred, isn't this great? As long as we can have tomatoes and water. Yeah, he eventually went to San Francisco when the scene was very hot there. And he died coming back from some train ride, some subway ride, and died of a heart attack. So these are the people in the book, some of them. Yeah, I'm talking too long. Maybe I should stop. Maybe I won't read anything. Maybe it just will end here. Like, what do you think? Tell me what you think. Anyone will tell me anything. Okay. You convinced me.
That was beautiful. A beautiful preface.
So this is, I hope, brief enough. It's the chapter when I go to the Art Students League the first time to be an artist. One Saturday morning in September, I took a subway down to 57th Street off 7th Avenue in Manhattan. In addition to my large sketch pad and batch of charcoal sticks, I carried with me a recent copy of The New Yorker. The New Yorker represented elegance and sophistication. Just asking for it at the newsstand made me feel special. I had stuffed a copy into my jacket pocket, so it would be seen when I got to the Art Students League, and I would be sure to declare me a person I belonged there. Each station further downtown brought me closer to my new life. The train elevated until 145th Street past tenements to whose naked windows I saw unmade beds, broken chairs, all the visible dreariness of lower middle class life, even some steps lower than mine. But soon I would mingle with fellow artists and dreamers of beauty, whose devotion to art elevated them above even the prospect of a life of poverty. There was no poverty where there was beauty, and all who created beauty, rich or poor, were equal. But once I got to the Art Students League building, my grand idea collapsed right away when I saw that I was not dressed properly for being an artist. Everyone was wearing jeans, even the women. I was in my tight-fitting two-year-old blue first communion suit and blue suede shoes, white shirt and plaid tie. And I was afraid that regardless of the New Yorker sticking out of my pocket, the Bronx hick would soon reveal himself the moment I entered the classroom. I waited until the last possible minute, until I shamed myself into some courage and walked in and took a stool among the 20 students chatting at their easels. I got some puzzled but not unfriendly looks, like, has this kid wandered into the wrong place? The room went still for a moment. Everyone was waiting and waiting. Then a young woman rushed in and sat on a chair on a raised platform. My heart fluttered. She took off her robe. She was naked. Her skin was creamy white. Her hair gleamed black and fell halfway down her back. Her breasts were full with pink nipples. I turned cherry red, and I was sure that everyone in the room had noticed, including the model. I had never seen a fully, completely, totally naked woman in my life. Everyone started to sketch very quickly. Then the model changed her pose, her arms raised over her head, her breasts heavy and alone. I started to draw, not knowing where to begin. Before I could even outline the torso with ovals that I had learned from my book, How to Draw from the Model, she took another pose. These were quick warm-ups, but they were too quick for me. I teetered between embarrassment and shame. I had expected some preparatory instruction on how to draw the body, but there was none of that. Everyone but me seemed knowing and confident as they silently sketched. While I was still floundering, the monitor called for a break, and the model put on her robe and disappeared. Some of the students passed by and glanced at my sketchbook, but I was too ashamed to let anyone see what I had done. And I quickly shut the pad with the scrawling lines and alleged drawing. I followed some of the students up the second floor. Everyone was smoking and chatting and laughing. No one spoke or glanced at me. I stood alone, lit a cigarette, and pretended to be concentrating on the nature of good and evil, the meaning of life and death, Plato's ideas of immortal perfect forms. But my thoughts really ran to how foolish and stupid I was to come into that room without any previous training and with only my fantasy and desire to be an artist. Then someone came over and said to me, "I'm Molly. Come over and join us." She was the model of a few minutes ago, and she and other models in their robes were sitting and smoking in an alcove. "Isn't he cute?" Molly said. I spotted him in my class. "Why are you here?" one asked. "Do you have a steady?" another one asked, whispered teasingly. It seemed that they had never seen someone as young as I in the life drawing classes. The redheaded model said, "Did you come here just to see girls get naked?" "Leave him alone," Molly said, putting her arm around my shoulder. "He's sweet." "I want to learn to draw," I said, in a voice as assured and grown up as I could muster, with undertones really shouted, "Please leave me alone. I'm just a kid." Before I could think further, the monitor announced that the break was over and we all returned. Molly smiled at me as we went down the stairs. I went back to the easel and flustered but thrilled by Molly's attention. I wanted to make great drawings to show her, to please her, to win her. The poses were longer, but that did not help me much. I was still scrawling unsteady lines. There was a faint rustling and a surge of electricity in the room. And then Ernest Feeney, the teacher, came in and he came over to examine my drawing. He stayed for a moment, then pointing to the feet and said very, very loudly, "What is she wearing?" "She's not wearing anything," I said, baffled by the question. "Oh," he said, "I thought she was wearing galoshes." There was some giggling in the room. He moved to the next student. When the class was over, a tall fellow in jeans and sport jacket with elbow patches came by and said, "Don't worry, feet are very hard to do. Hands are hard to do too." That was kind, but did not make up for my humiliation. I'd never be an artist unless I just splattered paint on the canvas with pretended anguish. All that night in my cot, I thought of Molly and her warm voice. I dreamed we were in Paris in a sexy hotel room with heavy drapes letting in just a little amount of light. She was wearing nothing but my beret. She kissed me everywhere. A week later, Feeney passed me up in his review. In my fourth week, he examined my drawing. I was humiliated that nothing had looked the way I had wanted, that there was no relationship between my eye and my hand. Molly's full breasts hung like deflated party balloons, the feet belong to a bear. Feeney and Lao Sotto Voce said, maybe you should try the life drawing class. No one laughed. During the break, Molly took me aside and said, he's a jerk. Everyone knows he's a jerk. Over the next few weeks, the models grew used to me, but by late October, my novelty had worn off, and they talked openly about their boyfriends and having sex with them. I was embarrassed, but more than that, I was wounded when one whispered to Molly, that Tony jerk of yours doesn't deserve you. Molly gave her a sharp glance as if to stop her from saying anything more in my presence, but it was too late. Molly had a boyfriend, and I was crushed. I returned to the class a few more times, and then, despite the pleasure of sitting with Molly and the models during their breaks and imagining myself an artist among women who loved artists, I stopped going. My drawings were no better than when I had started. They were worse, maybe, because now they were not only inept, but a tragedy of disproportions. An arm might be the same length as a leg. Hands were swelled to the size of footballs. I sulked everywhere, carrying with me the weight of my failure. On my last day, I told Molly I was leaving. She tousled my hair and said, I'll miss you, Fred. I was yearning to give her a real deep kiss, one that would tell her how much I dreamed of her and wanted to live with her forever. I was fighting back the tears. I'll miss you too, Molly, I said. I left the building without looking back, walking quickly, afraid that someone from my class would see me crying. I melted into the crowd in the subway to the faraway land of the Bronx. Now, I was just another high school dropout, and with no excuse, the cachet of being an artist, a star student with a fascinating future. I was an ordinary mailroom boy in an office with fluorescent lighting and rows of desks and clacking typewriters. All the same, over the following weeks, I tried to cling to the idea of Paris, because even if only by osmosis, there in the art-soaked streets where Van Gogh had walked, I would become the artist I was destined to be. In the place of classes at the Art Students League, I added some Saturdays to my work schedule and joined the extra income of my savings to go to Paris. I found an ad for the most inexpensive passage on the Holland line, a Holland America line, a freighter. And I calculated that even with helping my mother pay rent and other expenses, I would have saved enough money in a year to book passage and start my Parisian life. It never occurred to me to learn to speak French. Thank you, everyone, for being here, and all of you. Wish everyone here be safe and be happy. And thank you, everyone, James and Tasso and Ian and everyone who's been here to be part of it. Thank you very much.